tubes jutted from Vesley's head and throat. They were bunched at his shoulder, tied into a thick cable filled with fluids that bubbled pink and red. Less than 3 feet away, the tubes were joined in a similar manner to the neck of a naked, over-muscled hulk with a heavy metal visor and metallic cat-and-nine-tails whips in place of its hands. An arco-flagellant, the perpetrator of some unforgivable crime, mind-wiped and turned into a super-weapon at the hands of the Adeptus Mechanicus's most inhuman surgeons. Marikani had seen a pack of them in action during the Demon Wars of Terror, going from drooling inactivity to screaming berserk frenzy at the utterance of a simple trigger phrase from their Ministorum masters. "Now," said Varad, tapping a sequence into the rune nodes on the side of his servo skull. The azure light began to pulse, flashing arrhythmically as the apothecary leaned in close. "Danik Vesley. You do not clearly recall the events of the attack upon the fortification known as Sixth West. In fact, you do not wish to dwell on the events of the past at all. They are hazy and painful to summon to mind." A figure moved in close, blocking out the light. Morricone shut his eye completely once more, fighting the urge to spring up and fight, an urge that would almost certainly get him killed. Varad continued to talk from the alcove across the apothecarium. "Should you feel any surge of cerebral activity that is unusual, you will return to this state and remain comatose. Furthermore, when you hear a certain phrase, you will immediately make ready for conflict and concentrate only on those events about to unfold." Morricone felt a pain in the side of his neck. Just as his senses began to blur together, he heard Varad confirm a dark suspicion that turned him numb with betrayal and shock. "That phrase is battle stations." Chapter 14. Awful Truth. Apothecarium. The Executioner's Blade. Farron strode through the corridors of the Dark Angel's battle barge as it made its way from All Hallow to deep space. He had received his orders only a matter of hours ago and had not thought about much else. No matter how long he dwelt on them, they made as little sense to him as when he had first heard them. The entire Dark Angel strike force was to return to the planet Saltire Vex, this time to destroy its installations utterly for the sin of being tainted by Xenos. The notion of returning to a former war zone rankled in Farron's mind, especially after making the long haul from that location in the first place. There was something in the mindset of all Adeptus Astartes that demanded they kept going onward at all times, kept momentum so the enemy never had a chance to prepare for their devastating assaults. That said, with him having let the woman Deal go free, there was every chance the people they sought were no longer there. The whole affair could be an exercise in futility, or worse, a witch hunt with him as the traitor on trial. But that was not the part that rankled the most to Farron's mind. To attack the very people they had formerly bled for, striven for, given their lives to save from the Xenos invaders that were preying upon them, seemed galling in the extreme. Yet they had willingly left the Emperor's light to embrace the alien, and that was rightfully punishable by death. The dissonance made his jaw clench. The apothecarium was not far now. Less than an hour ago, Chaplain Zeroff had told him not to disturb the healing process by entering the chamber. He had told him that Morricone was making a full recovery, and that a lieutenant's duty should be in planning those attacks to be made in the future, rather than dealing with the fallout of those made in the past. The words had weight at the time. But Farron could no more ignore Morricone's plight than he could forget the sight of his brother's ruined flesh after the plasma malfunction. He had sent Thrun to the chaplain within minutes of his return to the Primaris contingent's quarters. The young warrior had questions of his own about what they saw in the dungeons of the keep, and sometimes the most honest and compelling motive of them all was a need for the truth. Whilst the big warrior kept the chaplain busy with simple questions that all had very complicated answers, Farron had time enough to seek out some truths of his own. He had already gone through the ritual of ungirding in his cell, padded out into the corridor in a woven robe, and headed for the apothecarium to see his old friend. Or what was left of him. All plasma weapons were volatile. It was why they had such a reputation in the armed forces of the Imperium. To be entrusted with their use was as much a curse as it was a blessing. But the Primaris Hellblasters knew their weapon tolerances better than even the plasma gunners of the Adeptus Astartes, for they were trained in the use of that one weapon above all others, and were at one with their machine spirit. To suffer such a catastrophic malfunction at a critical time, it had to be the work of the Psyker that had summoned the ether spawn to distract them as he escaped. The black armored figure they had run down in the keep. What had become of that figure since he had been incarcerated in the Dark Talon stasis hold, Farron did not know. Presumably he was languishing in a cell somewhere, if he had not already been executed. There was no way the lieutenant would be entrusted with any information as to his fate. That much was obvious. Zeroff and his fellows were not the giving type, and they seemed especially reticent to give any details when it came to the rebellion's leader. The corridors leading to the Apothecarium were wide, far wider than those of the Primaris contingent's quarters upon the Blade. The faint smell of counterseptic tingled at the back of Farron's nose as he passed a large vestibule area and approached the door. As a lieutenant, he had clearance to make his way in, though should Varad be inside at the time, he would no doubt have a difficult conversation ahead. The apothecary was as tight-knit with Zeroff as Gabriel and Ortinicus, and would not look kindly upon an unsanctioned visit. Should word reach Zeroff, the resultant interrogation about his motives would not be pleasant. The thick lintel of the apothecarium's entrance was framed by two skeletally thin caryatids that Farron at first took to be sculptural. When one of them whirred into life and stared at him, he was taken aback for a moment, but hid his discomfiture with a sign of the holy cog.
"Primaris Lieutenant Farron," he said.
"Denied," said the servitor, its voice as dry and rasping as two pieces of ground glass parchment rubbed together.
"Lieutenant Farron," he said, "formerly of the Indomitus Crusade."
"Denied."
Farron's eyes narrowed as he recognized the servitor's mech pattern. He reached up to the servitor's neck, peeled away the outer casing of two of the many tubes running from the cogitator pillar behind it into the back of its head, and carefully squeezed them flat with finger and thumb. Bereft of its mindlink chemicals, it squawked in alarm for a few moments, but was unable to send for help. After a while, it fell still, black liquid drooling from the side of its slack maw.
"The tech priests of Mars send their greetings," said Farron.
The apothecarium's vault doors ground open, the noise loud enough to have Farron darting a glance over his shoulder, despite his attempt to appear in command of the situation. He strode through, looking left and right for any sign of Varad. To his relief, there were only wounded warriors in the bay, each strapped to a slab, with cannulas and wheezing resp tubes attached to their torsos and necks. Farron passed a prone Dark Angel, whose legs were missing from the knees down, then the cybernetic replacements propped on a nearby lectern of dark green marble. To his right was a Space Marine who should by rights have been long dead, for his entire chest was caved in, as if by a massive boulder. A nest of pipes and wires was connected to the plugs in his black carapace, sucking and lugging as they took out extraneous fluids and added back in those needed to keep the warrior alive. The lieutenant raised his eyebrows. Any apothecary skilled enough to bring that severe a casualty back to active service was worthy of the name twice over. Farron's heart thumped as he scanned the rest of the beds. There was Morricani, strapped to a med slab at the back of the pillared hall. Despite his height and broad shoulders, he seemed shrunken, robbed of his easy posture and wry smile by the terrible wound that had laid him low. Almost as if he was already a corpse. Farron walked closer, his gait that of a thief trying his best not to make a sound. Even at a glance, he could see Morricani's wounds were awful. A morass of red, pink and black flesh, marbled with white streaks, and the odd gleam of bone covered his entire right side. In places, even his black carapace was burned away, the ribs and lungs beneath open to the air. The soft pink tissue beneath puckered and flexed, whilst ribbed and cartilaginous tubes gurgled softly from his torso.
"Pieter," said Farron softly. "Well met."
He waited for some sarcastic reply, but the figure on the bed lay still, motionless apart from the very faint motions of its breath.
"Pieter, I've come to wish you well. Can you hear me?"
A moment passed.
"No,"
came the faint reply, right on the cusp of hearing. Farron felt the guttering fire of hope in his soul flare to life once more.
"Thank the Omnissiah you're alive," he said. even if your sense of humour is still intact.
Barely.
What happened, Pieter? I don't believe for one moment you overcharged your incinerator that badly.
Didn't.
So why did it come to this?
Sab Atash,
said Marikani. Who would do that?
The first.
Not possible, said Farron. But even as he said the words, he knew that was not the case.
I saw some things, Farron.
What? Something you were not meant to see?
Yes. There was an accord in battle.
You mean the demon creatures?
No,
said Marikani.
Listen, Cedro. Just listen.
Farron cast a glance behind him across the apothecarium, but all was as he left it.
The first, said Marikani, talked with the Xenos.
A parley?
No,
wheezed Marikani, shaking his ravaged skull an imperceptible amount.
A pact.
How so? Did they unite against a common enemy?
Yes,
said Marikani. The demons?
Not exactly. They intimated they needed the Tau.
What for?
To attack Allhallow.
Farron stepped back, his mind whirling. Marikani had to be delirious. To side with a Xenos force over a successor chapter, it was unthinkable. There had to be some mistake.
What? Why do this?
The Angels of Absolution. They are tainted by a Psi plague.
Tainted?
That white Psi fire. It is infectious to other Adeptus Astartes.
Not all of them, said Farron, gesturing to his side.
It appears not. We must be made of stronger stuff.
And the Angels have become infected.
Yes, but we cannot purge it ourselves.
And the Tau can.
I hardly think they... Yes,
interrupted Marikani, exasperation quickening the wheezing of his breath.
They are all but psi-inert, dim souls, immune.
So the first ascending Xenos against their own successor chapter.
Oh, that can't be right.
Marikani's left eye, bloodshot and crusted with yellow discharge, slid over to meet Farron's gaze. For once, there was not an ounce of humour in it.
But why stray so far from the light, said Farron. Why not inform the Inquisition and have them deal with it?
Old secrets, said Marikani, must be kept.
And why would the Tau even agree to such a thing?
Farron's mind was already racing as it sought the answer. He thought of the stealther Tau they fought on Saltai of X, of the strange Psyker plague they first encountered there, and of their orders to head back and purge the site for good. The events had to be connected. More than that, they were cause and effect.
The Tau want us to attack their human allies in return, said Farron, as realization dawned. They want deniability, so they can keep up their pretense with every other human world they've lured into their empire. That's why we're heading back to the ocean world. We are to be their proxies and finish the rigors for good.
Marikani nodded, grimacing as the movement opened a furrow of wounds on his neck. Whitish yellow pus leaked out of the tiny chasms that appeared by his collarbone.
Who would make such a deal with a Xenos force? What would bring the first so low?
The quarry, said Marikani. Its secret must be worse.
Farron narrowed his eyes.
A quarry that summons demons to his side. That would be worse in my book.
True.
But to keep all this from the Inquisition, said Farron, frowning as the pieces fitted together in his mind.
That implies...
Morricani's left eyebrow raised just a little, a perfect curve of hair in comparison to the burned and slug-like wheel of flesh on the other side.
The quarry is one of us,
said Morricone, lifting a claw-like finger to point at the winged sword emblazoned upon Farron's robe.
A dark angel.
Farron felt sick. From the start, their enemy had not been a force of alien invaders, nor a rebellion, nor a psychic curse. It had been one of their own.
That cannot be. All this death, all this war, it cannot be for the sake of one lone traitor. I refuse to believe it.
Morricone struggled to sit up, his tube straining as flesh and skin cracked in shining red deltas across his burned flesh.
You know it is true,
he hissed. Farron's eyes went wide.
Calm,
he said, gently placing his hand over the side of Morricani's face that still looked vaguely human.
Calm, my friend.
The sergeant allowed himself to be pushed back down, his good eye sending spears of accusation at Farron, even as the white orb of his lost socket leaked whitish fluids across the ravaged flesh of his burns.
If this is true, said Farron coldly, I will keep the spark of this truth and nurture it until it becomes a flame, then an inferno. I will burn this conspiracy from the heart of the chapter if it is my last dying act.
Something shivered in Farron's mind, a sense of familiarity and a vision of strobing lights and faces peering down. He was about to dismiss it when he saw his friend's good eye creased with effort.
There is more. The memories, said Morricone. You told me. You have them, too.
The nightmares.
The memories, hissed Morricone. I heard Varad and Gabriel working on Vesle.
When?
Not sure. They thought I was out.
Farron said nothing, a chill sense of dread closing over him.
They were using fluids from a battle servitor.
To accelerate the healing process.
To mind wipe Vesle. Then me.
Something sank in Farron's stomach.
What?
He said. His mouth tasted of ash and of cold, dead things.
They remove our memories, said Morricone. They mind wipe us all. No!
Shouted Farron. His arms felt full of burning biofuel, his hands ready to rip and tear as hyperadrenaline thundered through his system.
They take our memories and send us to war, over and over. But they didn't know about our furnace. Keeps us half awake.
Farron felt the floor of his mind fall away for the second time in as many minutes. It made so much sense. The sensation of waking as if from deep meditation when they were going into battle. The flashbacks, the dreams, the sense of figures looking down and shining azure lights right in their faces. The fact that almost every one of the Primaris Marines had experienced the same thing at some point. They were being used as puppets, as distractions, as shields of flesh and bone to be hurled against a convenient enemy, whilst the real work was being done behind the scenes.
It's all lies, said Farron. This whole chapter is built on lies.
Morricone said nothing, his tubes wheezing as he stared up, unblinking at Farron.
What do we do now?
Said Farron softly.
Get to the heart of it, said Morricone. Expose it all.
Farron nodded somberly, something hardening inside his soul.
Yes, he said. That I can do.
Chapter 15. Savage Measures. Saltire Nearspace, Kroot War Sphere, Vork Karal. Gensadiel pushed the Arvis to its maximum speed. Once they had left Saltire's orbit, she'd been able to see her reflection against the starlit void, lit from below by the wan illumination of the cockpit displays. The visage there was that of a stranger, perhaps 20 years older, the skin more like a washed-out grey than her normal healthy brown. More than once, she had seen her long-dead mother in that reflection. Now the introspection of the void was a rapidly vanishing memory, eclipsed by the immensity in the middle distance. A Kroot war sphere. Part space station, part migratory city, part battleship. And entirely inhabited by ruthless alien cannibals that sought their strength from eating the bodies of the dead. The Xenos ship was slate grey and gunmetal, a little like two ringed city domes cut from a planet's surface and welded on either side of a massive spindle. It was oddly fascinating in its ugliness. No hint of streamlining or grace could be found here, nor even the jutting pugnacious arrogance of Imperial craft. This was an alien vessel in the truest sense of the word, built to satisfy sensibilities and desires that no human could truly understand.
"I can't believe you're taking us onto that thrown-down monstrosity," said Dallaggio, "especially with your whatever-it-is deal, your sickness. This is total madness."
Markins nodded.
"She's not wrong."
"So is staying behind,"
said Deal softly, steering the Arvus lighter towards the winking ingress lights she had been told to aim for by the mercenary xenocrats of Karu Non.
"So is waiting for death."
The rigger lined up the transport with what she assumed was the war sphere's docking bay. She engaged the craft's machine spirit, rudimentary though it was, to help guide her in safely, and focused hard on the approach. The war sphere grew steadily until it completely filled the viewscreen. She cast a glance down at the recommissioned pulse carbine she had stashed under the seat, reassured by its lethal lines.
"Okay," said Deal, huffing out a long breath through pursed lips. "Anyone know anything about Kroot that we haven't already covered?"
Markins spoke up.
"Remember that water cast operative back on Thetoid last summer, Agro? As he put it, they have a distinct scent."
"So they stink," said Dallaggio. "Bad."
No one laughed. The war sphere loomed even larger now, the details on its surface visible. Everything about it was wrought on a massive, crude scale, as if it had been built by some cyclopean race of titans. In parts, the outside of the sphere seemed to be overgrown by cables, winches, and badly welded girders, a separate and more organic superstructure yearning to get out. It reminded Deal of the Pict captures that had fascinated her as a child, her visual book images of majestic column-like arboreals throttled by parasitic vines of bright green. The ingress lights blinked in series, silently guiding them into the pipe-lined passageway that led inside. To Deal's fevered mind, the ingress point looked a lot like the gullet of some strange cybernetic beast.
"In we go. So your plan is to persuade them to help us with a single barrel of promethium," said Dallaggio. "And you think that will be enough to convince them to face down whatever retribution is sent our way?"
"Up to and including a strike force of space marines," added Markins.
"Do you have any more realistic ideas?" snapped Deal, balling her fist to keep them from trembling. "Any old friends in system that could make a difference?"
Dallaggio said nothing.
"So we go in," said Deal. "Just don't say anything to them."
"That's not her forte," said Markins.
What if you have an episode, like before?" said Dallaggio. "I've had a headache ever since." "Then I reckon you'll have to take it up from where I leave off," said Deal. "Saltire Vex is counting on you, even if it doesn't know it."
Another long silence. Deal guided the Arvus lighter further in, as the ingress portal led them to a massive dark hangar. A double set of vault doors irised open and shut as the lighter passed, and the lighter's pressure gauge flashed as they formed an airlock. Dimly lit, the inside of the starship seemed half derelict. Around the edges of the wide, low-ceiling dock were the scatterings of ships from half a dozen races, each dormant and part disassembled at the edges of sight. A strange black discoloration, a little like the oil mould that clung to the lower layers of the rigs, had claimed a fair few of them, and some even boasted small clusters of vegetation. Here and there, condensation dripped from the rust-spattered ceiling. The columns of lights that had guided them in turned through 90 degrees and winked towards a wide, empty berth.
"Guess we set down here, then," said Dallaggio. "Where is everyone?" muttered Deal. "Some welcoming committee."
"Fine by me," said Markins. "You need someone to watch the lighter, of course. I hereby volunteer."
"Not a chance," said Dallaggio.
You're going to make good friends with that barrel, hauling it up any stairs, pushing it up ramps, carrying it over rope bridges, whatever we find.
If I do that, said Markins, and if we make it back, and if our ship hasn't already been stripped for parts, then you have to officially make me Rigsman Second Class.
Ugh, said Delagio. Fine.
The Arvus lighter set down hard with a triple clunk, the pneumatic hissing of its landing gear audible even inside the cockpit.
Sorry, said Deal. Bad landing. You're not vomiting white gunk today, said Delagio, so as far as I'm concerned, you're doing fine.
Deal unclipped her harness and made her way to the back of the lighter before stepping out into the hangar beyond. The air was humid, horribly so. Already she could feel sweat pricking at her back, her armpits, the old wounds in the backs of her legs.
It's hot as a burnsman's forge in here, said Delagio.
Smells even worse, grunted
Markins, manhandling the promethium barrel they had taken from Thetoid and rolling it out of the back of the Arvus with a loud clang. Deal waved them quiet, but the big man had a point. The place was truly foul, home to an acrid stink that stuck like rancid fat to the back of the throat. Deal flexed the muscles in her nose to block her nostrils from the inside, an old rigger's trick. It made her voice sound as strange as if she had ignifluenza, but it had saved her from nausea 100 times over, especially when mucking out the drops.
Just deal with it, she said in a nasal monotone, and keep your eyes wide.
The ingress light suddenly changed, winking in a new pattern that led them into the cavernous rear of the hangar. At the back was a corridor, roughly oval in shape and ridged with thick stanchions that reminded Deal of the rings of cartilage reinforcing a human trachea. Long pipes and ribbed cables ran along its length, like tendons and veins, reinforcing the impression they were venturing into the innards of some immense steel giant. With Deal taking point, pulse carbine held ready, the three riggers made their way onwards into the gloom. Jensa cast a glance backwards. Delagio was at her shoulder, watchful eyes under a tattooed scalp, her pulse pistol concealed somewhere under her raincape. Markins was dutifully rolling the promethium barrel along in front of him, trickles of sweat on his heavy arms and fat-rolled neck. The heavy steel drum made a low, grinding rumble as it traversed the passageways. Audible even under the bass thrum of the Warsphere's engine units, it put them all on edge.
"Should have lined its riches with Packer's tape," muttered Deal. "Too late now."
There was a strange, guttural caw from ahead. All three of them stopped for a moment, their attention fixed on a shadow that flickered in the flashing light of the ingress lumens. A hunched avian cocked its head at them, ruffling its mangy feathers. It shook the sheaf of quills behind its beady eyes and a long, jagged beak.
Right, said Deal. Probably some kind of pet.
There was a flicker of movement.
Or a distraction, she continued, slowly lowering the barrel of her gun. Don't make any sudden moves.
She turned slowly to see four figures dropping down from the pipes above, their olive-green anatomies lithe and sparse. Clawed feet, like those of birds, clanged onto the metal floor of the corridor, and long rifles, each of which was tipped at either end by vicious blades, whipped around to point right at them. Deal felt oddly proud that two of the four were pointed at her, leaving one each for Delagio and Markins. The Xenos stared over their blunt, beak maws with penetrating black eyes. The nests of quills that jutted from the back of their heads fanned up, as if to make their silhouettes larger. The quills rattled, whilst some tinkled where nuts and metal trinkets had been woven in amongst them. The Kroot were clad in leather and covered in what looked like thick, fatty grease. In places, it was dark and streaked like war paint.
"We are here to parley," said Deal in low Gothic.
She felt something lift one of her dreadlocks from behind and turn just a fraction to see the tip of a rifle blade an inch from her eye. The blade tugged a few more dreadlocks free, its owner making the approximation of a cackle before letting it fall.
"Parley!"
cawed the Kroot in front of her, a scarred brute some 8 feet in height. He was missing a large portion of his skull and had a scorched black augmetic in its place.
"Saltor Vekas!"
he trilled, his pointed black tongue sticking out from his blood-encrusted jaws.
"Saltor Vex! Yes," said Deal. "We want to hire you."
The Kroot threw back their heads, making shrill cawing sounds that Deal was almost sure were mocking her. She smiled insincerely.
"Come to see Master Shaper," said the Kroot leader.
He shouldered past her roughly, his fellows close behind. The bodily contact left a smear of evil-smelling fat on Deal's shoulder. Under the grease, his anatomy had been hard, strong, little more than muscle over bone. It felt hungry somehow.
"Deal," said Delagio softly. "I think he said, come to see Master Shaper."
"Huh," said Markins. "That sounds like who we want, right?"
He put his weight against the Promethean drum and started rolling it once more. The Kroot ahead clicked and cawed to one another, making the shrill mocking sound once more as they went.
"I hope so, Markins," said Deal,
noticing a patch of stitched pink leather dangling from the rearmost Kroot's belt. The hairs on her neck and forearms stood up as she realized it had eyes, nostrils, and a mouth.
"I really very much hope so."
The cavernous space of the Kroot leader's court was huge. Oppressively hot and stinking of acrid Xenos flesh, it was lined with hundreds of tall, branching structures, each somehow reminiscent of Deal's old arboreal picked book. Yet this jungle was made of girders, coiled wire, and iron stanchions twisted out of true. Lithe, quadrupedal shadows slinked in its reaches, jaws agape, whilst dozens... No, Deal thought as she looked closer... Hundreds of Kroot mercenaries leaned against, sat near, and dangled from the steel trees. They were hard to make out, deliberately so, for their grease-painted skin was streaked with dark discoloration by way of camouflage. Tendrils of actual vegetation hung from the structures in places, and strange multi-jointed insects buzzed and fluttered in shafts of light that stabbed down from above. The largest beam illuminated the king of this strange assembly. Seated on an immense pile of captured weapons and bone trophies, at the heart of the cavernous space, he was massive, even by the standards of his looming kindred. The sheaf of greyish quills that protruded from his skull stuck out in all directions, each spine-like appendage adorned with complex metal jewellery, and his eyes were covered by complex infrascopic goggles that would have looked more suited to a space marine scout than a barbarian warlord. A hunched, elderly Kroot perched on his haunches on a rickety platform at the warlord's side, wearing a cloak of long feathers and a stylized leather mask, holding his own sheaf of quills. He stood unsteadily, propping himself on a gnarled staff of lacquered heartwood.
"Humans, bow before the Grey King," he said in a harsh croak.
Shivering, Deal bowed low. Markins followed suit after shoving his barrel upright with a clang that sent 100 bladed rifles clattering upwards to focus on him. He froze mid-bow, not daring to stand again.
"That will not bow,"
said the feather-clad speaker, motioning at Delagio.
"That's right," said the rigger loudly. "I do not. Far too much."
A shadow moved nearby. The hilt of a Kroot rifle thumped into Delagio's gut, hard enough to send her to her knees in a wheezing, red-faced ball.
"You do now," said the speaker.
The Grey King gave a croaking bass caw that was a little too much like human laughter for comfort.
"You come as food," said the speaker,
cocking its head.
"Small flesh,"
it added, its quills dipping in disappointment. The pungent stench of the place was getting thicker. It was so foul it was beginning to make Deal's eyes water. That was what she told herself, at least. She was definitely not tearing up through fear.
"We come as employers," she said, keeping her voice steady, "to enlist your services as mercenaries. All of you."
A great cacophony of cawing, barking, hooting and clapping of hands came from all around as the metal jungle came to life, the sound deafening in its sudden intensity. Deal waited for it to subside. Sure enough, the Grey King raised a giant clawed hand and the assembly gradually fell quiet.
"You want to hire us,"
said the speaker, his tone harsh. The feathers on his back fanned out, and Deal realized with a start that they were not a cloak, as she had first thought, but wings.
"What could you possibly offer us?"
Willing every ounce of her self-control into keeping her hand steady, Deal held up a finger. She took out the hip flask and tinder switch she had seconded from Delagio from her jerkin, a dozen rifles swinging around to cover her as she did so, and unscrewed the top.
"Alcohol,"
said the Grey King, his posture stiffening in his chair. He snorted like a rhino about to charge.
"No,"
said Deal, swigging a big gulp from the flask whilst fighting the urge to vomit. She flicked the tinder switch and, lips pursed, breathed out a great cloud of promethium droplets. They caught instantly. A massive pillar of flame and greasy black smoke shot up from her lips to the ceiling, sending crazy shadows dancing in the metal trees and sending the assembly into a hooting, cawing cacophony once more. "Promethium," she said, kicking Markin's barrel with her steel-toed boot. It gave a pleasingly loud clang.
"Pure, undiluted fire juice."
"We have that," said the speaker.
His tone was still harsh, but his wings were folded back again, and his eyes were bright. He flung out a hand.
"We are Warsphere Vorkkarau. One barrel is nothing."
"This is just a quality sample of our goods," said Deal. "We have literally tens of thousands of barrels of the finest stuff. Tens of thousands. All you need to do is land, and we roll it aboard. One berth, one barrel."
"One berth, one barrel," said the speaker.
"Yes. Then we debark at the next system along and leave the goods with you. You'll have all the fuel you need for years, decades. And there's room enough on this vessel for all of us."
"Is there?"
hissed the Grey King.
"You have weapons of Tau, servant,"
said the feathered speaker, pointing at her pulse carbine. He had made Tau two staccato halves and mangled a few syllables, but the more he spoke to her, the better his facility with Low Gothic seemed to get. She had heard of the Kroot's ability to mimic others, but to see it in practice was truly impressive. No wonder they made such adept mercenaries.
"We are not bound to great good,"
the speaker called, something close to disdain in his eyes and the cocking of his head.
"Here, away from septs, we do as we see fit."
"The Tauva is a noble ideal," said Deal, "and it united our planet once. But there are those amongst the Tau that would see us dead, just for the crime of being human. What kind of unity is that?"
The rhetorical question hung in the air. Deal could not tell if it was the silence of contemplation or whether the Kroot had lost interest and were thinking of their next meal.
"We come to you as independents," she said, pressing on, "as a people with much to offer, but no allies to offer it to."
There was another long silence.
"One berth, one barrel," said the speaker, tilting his jaw back.
"Yes,"
he nodded, running a string of finger bones through his talons.
"Tell more,"
he snapped.
"We make pact."
Deal felt a cold shroud lift from her heart, fluttering above it, but ready to descend once more.
"Halt it,"
said the Grey King. Down came that shroud over Deal's heart.
"How do we know?"
said the warlord.
"How do you tell truth we know?"
Deal frowned.
"I don't lie. Check the quality of that barrel's contents if you don't believe it's the good stuff."
"Not enough,"
said the speaker, slowly shaking his head.
"To risk war, Sphere, I say to you, no, we cannot." "Come here,"
said the Grey King, extending a long talon and beckoning Deal closer. The talon was like the claw of some ancient saurian, scaled and black-nailed. It had three other claws ready to grasp, to rip, to plunge into human flesh behind it.
"Come!"
Deal stepped forward hesitantly, then caught herself and strode, confidence radiating from her every step, despite the fact she felt nothing but pure terror inside.
"Gift me,"
said the warlord, motioning at her fingers.
"I will taste truth."
Every instinct in Deal's mind screamed at her not to hold her hand out. She held her hand out anyway. The warlord grabbed it, enfolding her brown digits in his giant claw. His grip was a wrench vice, inescapable. The warlord leaned in, his acrid stench overpowering,
His eyes, though hidden behind the high-spec Imperial sniper goggles, seemed to bore into her. Then the warlord's massive, jagged beak, more like that of a snapping turtle than a bird, darted forward and clipped off two-thirds of Deal's little finger in a single motion. Deal's lips curled as she fought with all her being not to scream. She yanked her hand back and pinched the stem of her severed finger to save from drizzling blood all over the makeshift throne. The warlord sat back, licking the edge of his beak clean of Deal's blood. She heard the crunch of her own finger bones as the master shaper chewed thoughtfully on her flesh.
"Ha!"
he said, eventually, as if surprised. The feathered speaker clicked and whistled in the unintelligible Kroot tongue.
"She is truth-teller," said the Grey King in response, nodding. "And Psi-spiced. Siling," said the speaker, his eyes glinting as his quills rose high. "Good meat for Shaman." "No," said the king, shaking his head. "Too use fuel."
The Shaman's quills drooped once more.
"One birth, one barrel," said the giant Xenos, thoughtfully, looking down at Deal.
She was shaking now, uncontrollably.
"Yes," she said. "Just get us off Saltire Vex and put us down somewhere safe, warm. We don't care where."
"You seek warm," said the Kroot monarch,
eyelids lowered.
"Yes," she nodded. "Please."
"Done."
A flood of relief washed over Deal as she backed away, bowing low. She saw the black spots return at the edge of her vision and fell back, only to feel Dellagio catch her and carry her back over to Markins.
Whilst Dellagio tore off a strip of cloth from her cuff and bound the finger stump as best she could, Deal leaned heavily against Markin's reassuring bulk. The smell of his stale sweat was reassuringly human after the olfactory assault of the Kroot's stench grease. Deal frowned. Come to think of it, she could hardly smell the vile stench of the Kroot. It had all but disappeared.
"Go now,"
said the speaker from atop the podium.
"Ready your people. We will come for you on 15 days from here."
15 days, said Dellagio pensively, "with the evac protocols already in place."
She paused, counting on her fingers.
"And by then, the waters around the ricks will already have started to float."
Two heavy-set Kroot approached Markins and yanked the promethium drum away from him, cawing harshly in triumph as they carried the barrel between them to the rear of the warlord's throne.
"All yours," said Markins. "You're welcome to it."
Jensa felt her senses swim back into focus as the Kroot king waved them away. She leant heavily on Markins as they made their way back to the lighter.
"Deal, my girl," said Dellagio, the dragons on her eyebrows kissing as she frowned. "I think I might just love you a little bit."
15 days later. The vast sideways domes of the descending starship were blurred by the punishingly cold winds that whipped across Saltai Vex's ice floes, but Jensa Deal could see them growing clearer by the minute. Well over a mile from the tip of one dome to the other, the vessel was as incongruous and unsettling as a vast metallic meteor hanging suspended in the sky. Yet to the people of Saltai Vex, the arrival of the war sphere was their salvation. Deal looked back to see long columns of huddled refugees stretching behind her, thousands of riggers shuffling across the ice floes that had slowly, inevitably formed over their ocean. The floes were a sign of the deathly temperatures the planet would plunge to as it continued on its elliptical journey away from the star Saltiros. Amongst the riggers, it was said that if you saw an ice floe, it was already too late. Now that supposition was being put to the test. The rigger families, making their way from the lowest pontoons of the rigs, were wrapped up so completely they looked more like columns of penguins than people. Deal knew that some of them had made the trek from one rig to another, across dozens of sites, using them as staging posts for a far larger pilgrimage towards the rendezvous point of ferro-giant Thetoid. Many had made their journey on boats, ferries or low-altitude flyers. Others had crossed on ice skiffs or even canid sleds as the floes had closed their grip around the promethium rigs. Each of them wore a barrel of promethium, though some were larger than others. The terms that Deal had laid out to her fellow chiefs were clear enough, but she had not specified the size. The strongest amongst the refugees rolled barrels even larger than the ones Markins had carried to the war sphere by way of an example, whereas the children carried barrel-shaped pails that sloshed with half-frozen promethium sludge. It galled Deal to think that hundreds of riggers had already died in this great exodus, fallen through the ice, perished from exposure in the storms that lashed them every week, or simply frozen to death as their bodies gave up entirely. Yet thousands more had made it to the rendezvous site in time. Great crowds of her people stamped their feet, hugged themselves, and stared up at the sky as the war sphere gradually made its way down towards them. Deal pulled out the auspicator tube she had taken from Thetoid's surveyor nook and focused it on the colossal starship as it grew ever closer. The lower strata of its composite hull was now discoloured with some weird manner of cork, no doubt an insulating material of some kind, intended to protect it from the imminent landing. On the cusp of hearing, Deal could make out the sounds of her people crying out, some in outrage, others in awe, or in sheer grateful disbelief that their Arctic nightmare was about to end.
"Ungrateful bastards," said Delagio, shivering hard.
She had been copiously sick the night before in their shared bunk, and had not had anything positive to say ever since. Deal could not shake the image of white ectoplasm gouting and spraying from between Delagio's teeth as she tried desperately not to let the psychic energies roiling inside her fly out of control.
"Not all of them," said Deal, "and you can bet your last coin that none of them will stay."
"I'm looking forward to getting back into that stinking nest," said Markins, blowing into his cupped hands. "At least it's warm in there."
The three riggers watched in silence as the war sphere slowly, majestically lowered itself into the ice floes with a grinding bass crunch. Jets flared from dozens of ports on the outside of the dome rings, slowing the descent, but still the landing was anything but elegant. The thing threw tidal waves of freezing water into the air as it bellied down, vast sprays of spume erupting. Clouds of steam wreathed its underside as the heat of its atmospheric entry was counteracted by the ice water. For a long while, nothing happened. The susurrus of awed whispers amongst the populace began to rise, with some louder voices shouting out in impatience. Then, just as Deal feared a riot might break out, several massive chunks of metal folded away from the war sphere. They hinged down, coming to rest upon the larger ice floes in a spray of ice crystals.
"Right then," said Delagio. "Right then," replied Deal.
She cast a look at Markins, and he shrugged.
"Let's get off this icy death trap," he said. "I, for one, won't miss it."
Somehow, Deal knew the big man was lying. But that was all right. Chapter 16. Confrontation. Saltire Near Space. Approaching Kroot War Sphere. The Executioner's Blade. A servo skull drifted into the communal space where the Primaris Marines sat around their mess table, its spinal cord waving like a tentacle.
"Lieutenant Farron," came Apothecary Varad's tinny voice from its augmeter. "Sergeant Pavel, Brother Gazar, Brother Thrun, Brother Enrod, please report to the Apothecarium immediately for routine psi scan."
Farron took a deep breath, sharing a look with his brothers. Even Enrod cast him a glance, his usual studied indifference replaced by genuine concern. It had not been long since the lieutenant had visited them in their cells and passed on what he had learned from Morricani.
"Here we go, then," said Thrun.
"Yes," said Farron. "Time for the routine procedure we discussed."
"Is there no way around this?" asked Pavel.
"Sadly not. We cannot afford to lose that which we worked so hard to gain."
The lieutenant turned to go, and as one, the Primaris Marines filed out behind him. Nothing of their usual surety remained in their step, only a profound unease. To Farron, their expressions were those of condemned men going to the gallows.
"This shouldn't take too long," said Farron. "Gazar, you have what we discussed?"
"Aye,"
he said, rapping his knuckles on the combat knife under his robe. The amount of anger and disappointment the repulsor driver managed to convey in that single syllable was impressive. They followed the servo skull with its weird dangling spinal cord for a full 15 minutes, passing through vaulted corridors and echoing munitions halls as they made their way from one side of the executioner's blade to the other. Not another word was spoken until they reached the apothecarium. The smell of counterseptic reached them before the MedSuite's caryatid servitors came into view at the end of the corridor. As Farron recalled, there was a small vestibule area off to the side, an area where those who were yet to seek the apothecary's services were encouraged to wait in meditative contemplation of the procedures to come.
"In here,"
he said, motioning for his brothers to go inside. They filed in wordlessly. The macabre servo skull drifted in after them, its flickering azure lumen dimly casting a pool of illumination across the floor.
"Procedure imminent," it buzzed.
"Kindly inform Apothecary Varad we are here," said Farron, "and relate to him that we're finding a constant biorhythm in preparation for his procedure. It is a Primaris-specific ritual. We will be ready for Psyscan in precisely 6 minutes."
The servo skull nodded in midair.
6 minutes. Acknowledged, it said,
turning to slide away with a soft hum of anti-gravitic motors.
"Is that enough to fire it up?"
asked Enrod, once the apothecarium's door had slid closed behind the floating skull.
"Trust me," said Farron. "I'm well aware of the timescales here. Gazar, your combat knife, please. We need to make this quick and subtle."
Gazar unclipped the combat knife, 16 inches of razored hypersteel, so sharp it could saw through an iron stanchion, and flipped it, proffering it hilt first to the lieutenant.
"No," said Farron, pushing the blade back towards Gazar. "We each deliver the wound to another."
He raised his arm and pointed to the dent beneath.
"Through the armpit, into the heart. Close it quick, so it has time to clot. By my calculations, that will be easiest to conceal."
He looked at Enrod, expecting him to call out the plan as madness, or even denounce it altogether as he strode out with not so much as a backwards glance. His battle brother simply met his gaze and nodded. Pavel, to his left, crossed his forearms in the Primaris salute.
"Gazar," said Farron, turning his flank. "Do it."
The tank driver lunged. Farron felt a blinding white pain burst in his mind as the long-bladed dagger sank to the hilt in his armpit. It scraped bone before pricking his primary heart. Gazar took the dagger out, slicked red from hilt to tip with the lieutenant's blood, and passed it to Thrun. As the big warrior took it and lined up the point under Gazar's raised arm, Farron could already feel the chemicals pulsing through his bloodstream from his Belisarian furnace. They were pushing his system into overdrive, a rapid response to the blade's intrusion into the meat of his heart. Thrun put the heel of his hand against the blade's hilt and pushed it home into Gazar's chest. The tank driver grimaced and breathed quickly in and out, his eyes watering and tendons standing out on his throat as his ribcage was penetrated and his heart was pierced. He shook, as if in revulsion, but he still stood. The combat blade slid out of his torso, then Thrun passed it to Barvel. The bald sergeant nodded solemnly as Enrod raised his arm and turned his head away.
"This is a true bond of brotherhood, you realize," said Pavel, as he placed the tip against Enrod's bare flesh. "This is different from the kinlines of the chapter, or even of loyal allegiance to the Primarch. This bond is ours, and ours alone."
Pavel pushed the long knife hard, its impossibly sharp tip slicing through sinew coils and black carapace alike. Enrod stifled a cry, biting his knuckles so hard they bled, but he kept silent, only gasping when the blade came out once more. Then it was Thrun's turn to have the blade pushed into his heart, and finally Pavel's, with Farron wielding the knife. The five Space Marines stood, with blood dripping down their flanks. Their chests were heaving, as if they had each gone 20 rounds in the practice cages, as their Belisarian furnaces pumped a heady mix of stims around their bloodstreams. Farron could already feel the veins in his arms and thighs pulsing, becoming acutely aware of blood clotting under his arm as the hypercoagulant chemicals of his hemostamen went to work.
5 minutes, he said, his jaw clenched involuntarily. Clean up any blood splatter before that cogdamn skull comes back, and keep your biorhythms from spiking if you can. Just ride it out.
The Primaris Marines went to work, each one dabbing at the clot where Gazar's blade had gone into their flesh. So sharp was the combat knife, so resilient their flesh, that the wounds were all but invisible when their arms were lowered, just as Farron had hoped. Yet the operation had not been a precise science. None of them were apothecarium trained. By the blood trickling from his armpit, the combat knife had severed one of Thrun's major veins.
"Just hold it tight,"
said Farron, his vision pulsing slightly in time with his heartbeat as his furnace went to work.
We only have to get in there. Even as he spoke, he knew it was a lie. How did they ever hope to disguise all the blood from a trained apothecary, especially one as adept as Varad, less than a minute away from examining them? Four of the wounds had clotted, but the fifth...
6 minutes,
came a metallic voice from behind Farron. He spun, almost knocking into the floating skull and spinal column that formed Varad's med familiar.
The apothecarium is ready to heal you.
Farron cast a glance back at Thrun. The big warrior took his hand from his armpit, the rich red of fresh blood still obvious in his palm.
No choice, he mouthed.
The five ventured into the apothecarium, Farron at their head. He could feel his blood thundering in his veins as he saw the berth where Morricani still lay, a dark velvet curtain drawn across it. No doubt he was being kept on the threshold of consciousness until the time was right to use him as a weapon once more. Apothecary Varad was at the far end of the chamber, bent almost double over the corpse of a dead space marine. He was suturing closed the hole where the progenoid glands had been. As he finished, he placed a full gene flask carefully on the desk.
Back to the chapter, he said
in his strange rasp, his augmented jaw glinting as he turned.
The ultimate fate of us all.
Just so.
Just so indeed, Lieutenant Farron. Though in the fullness of time you will undergo a similar procedure. Today you and your brothers are here for a psi scan. It is a routine procedure after exposure to an unsanctioned psychic presence. There is nothing untoward about it.
I see, said Farron, fighting to keep his tone level. Brothers, to the slabs. Wordlessly, the Primaris climbed onto the level berths, one in each alcove. Farron felt his pulse thunder all the harder as he saw Thrun trailing bright spots of blood in his wake.
You are wounded, battle brother Thrun, said Varad,
kneeling to examine the blood. His servo skull flew in close, its azure light turning the spilt vitae black.
My fault,
said Enrod, holding up his knuckles. They were red with blood, flesh peeled back where he had gnawed on them to stifle the pain of their furnace-triggering pact.
A slight disagreement settled in the warrior fashion. The others broke it up, but I proved myself to have the more compelling argument.
Varad hissed through his teeth, turning away in disgust to run his hands over a tray of syringes. He selected one, attaching it to the primary manipulator arm of his servo skull.
You will keep that temper in check, he said,
his voice passionless as that of a Cataphron battle servitor,
if you wish to earn your true place in the Dark Angels chapter.
Of course,
said Enrod, his tone contrite. Farron caught his eye. There was something unfamiliar there, under the too wide stare of one whose furnace burned hot. Collusion, perhaps.
A little cortex sedative now, said Varad, administered to prepare you for the psi scan.
Varad's servo skull hovered in close to Farron, the syringe glinting in the bluish light of its lumen. He bared his throat, knowing that in doing so he approached the precipice of amnesia. Furnace or not, there was a distinct possibility he would forget everything, waking once more in the hold of the Night Harrower, with his hands checking his bolt rifle for the 100th time.
Just let yourself relax,
buzzed Varad, as azure light shone brightly into the lieutenant's eyes.
This will not take long, and then everything will be as it should.
Inside, the beast caged behind Farron's heart raged wild. Chapter 17. The Blade Unsheathed. Viewing Dome. The Liminal Conquest. Progress Class Starcruiser, Slipstream enabled, flagship of the Fourth Sphere expansion. Tutor Twiceblade stared balefully at the Holovis suite as his High Commander replayed an airborne view of the events transpiring on the primitive planet far below. The sight was visible as a green smudge on the viewing dome's voidscape, but it was shown in pinpoint detail on the subsidiary hex informationals. It looked forbidding for a primitive structure, especially swathed in smoke. Upon entering the system, Commander Surestrike had impressed upon all of Vray rank or higher that such sites were to be treated with extreme caution. At one point, Twiceblade had not known why.
What harm could such a primitive, even feudal government pose to an advanced civilization such as that of the Tau? Yet now, watching the relay unfolding before him, he began to see just what such planets represented. Anarchy, raw and infectious as a suppurating wound. The fortress that Surestrike had descended to in his Cold Star was once a formidable defensive position, albeit static, but he had left it little more than a smoking ruin. The High Commander had already transloaded his drone's war footage to the Firecast's information web, and Twiceblade had memorized nearly every detail of the recordings, even editing together the relevant sections in a flagrant breach of cast protocol. He and Surestrike had resolved to understand every nuance, just in case they had missed something about the Gweiron Shah and their strange servants. On the Hex informationals, thick black smoke belched from the fortress's towers, its walls, the stairways that led to its subterranean levels. Its courtyard was strewn with the remnants of mutant human bioforms, some ripped apart or mangled so violently they appeared savaged by a pack of great Narloks. Figures staggered or fled from the tumbled walls and shattered gatehouses of the primitive megastructure for the woods around. Some were cut down by explosive rounds as they fled, others making it to the apparent safety of the tree line.
"Observe this pattern," said Surestrike.
The display zoomed out, rushing backwards as the drones that assembled the footage took a new vantage point. The fleeing humans were lit with various designators and target locks as they fled. After reaching a mile or so from the site of the carnage, many of them were snuffed out, their designators disappearing. Others were consumed by sudden white fires that blazed bright before their designators turned from silver to red.
"This footage is from the last diurnal rotar," said the commander, a note of sadness in his voice. "We already know the quarantine has not been effective. Those infected by the mind plague have proven to be highly unpredictable."
The footage zoomed out again. Several other structures were on fire within a 20-mile radius of the first, columns and palls of black smoke trailing westward in the prevailing wind.
"And there is no way of tracking down those elements that have escaped whilst they are still relatively contained?" asked Tutor Twiceblade. "Surely the Earthcast have some manner of delineator."
Commander Surestrike made the downward gesture of the saddened soul.
"They have nothing we could use."
"Then the infection will spread," said Twiceblade. "We cannot engage and destroy every craft that leaves a Gweiron Shah homeworld without initiating a full-scale war."
"That is true," said Surestrike. "And the Gweiron Shah delegates we spoke with upon the derelict space station already realized that."
The High Commander turned, a strange light in his eyes.
"That is why they gave us this."
Surestrike motioned to the artifact held aloft on a cushion of anti-gravitic energies, projected from a hover disk that Tutor Twiceblade could have encompassed with his arms. The human relic was a yellowed skull in a vise of metal. To Twiceblade, the macabre thing seemed blunt and simian, its powerful jaw, wide orbits, and a heavy brow, the hallmarks of a primitive but effective hunter.
"They believe this can be used to seek out those who are infected," said Surestrike, "be they Gwela or Gweiron Shah, yet they cannot be the ones to do it."
To Twiceblade, the human skull seemed a vile and atavistic thing, yellowed with immense age and surrounded by a mechanism of primitive pincers and coils. It seemed all the more anachronistic next to the clean, high-tech lines of the hover disk that held it upright. Gaping sockets stared up at the tutor, the whole artifact seeming to laugh at him with its maddening rictus grin.
"Is that purely some manner of primal fetishistic artifact?" asked the tutor. "Or does it have an actual use?"
"It may seem too surreal to contemplate given its lack of technological embellishment," replied Surestrike. "But according to the mind science specialist Dothrael, it will emit a signal of some kind whenever a psyker is close."
"Now doubt it has circuitry laid into the actual bone," said Twiceblade.
"As you say," nodded Surestrike sagely. "Though having seen what we witnessed in the subrealm, there can be no surety as to what measure of mind science infects it."
Twiceblade suppressed a shudder.
"Ultimately, it is largely irrelevant," continued Surestrike. We have not the sanction to use it from an elemental council, nor the tools needed to track down and slay every infected human on a stronghold planet of highly trained elites.
Nodding absently in agreement, Tutor Twiceblade said nothing. His thoughts had turned to the tale of Commander Farsight, as they often did. Farsight and his darker counterpart.
I must talk with the Aun immediately, said Surestrike. All of those we have left, that is. I have already petitioned for an audience, and they have granted it, for it is no secret that I need their guidance.
He made the gesture of the lost swan before continuing.
Please feel free to use this viewing dome as your own tutor and meditate upon your own course. I shall be taking my Saznami with me, of course, so you will be without guardianship.
I see, said Twiceblade, subconsciously making the sign of the dutiful servant.
It was an uninspired choice, but it would have to